that it had befallen all of us. Suddenly it would have taken more strength than I had. I let it go. I let it all go. And now it's too late for there ever to be anything for you and me.
Oh, Fitz.
And even in rebuke, for me to hear my name from her lips was a sort of sweetness.
For you, it has always been too late or too soon. Always some day, always tomorrow, or after you do this one last duty for your king. A woman needs a chance for something to be now. I needed that. I'm sorry we had so little of it.
A little time longer we sat there, in our own sorry silence. Then she said quietly,
"Chivalry will be bringing the little ones to me soon. I promised they could stay until the last puppet show. It would not do for them to find you here. They would not understand. And I could not explain."
And so I left her, bowing to her at her door. I had not touched so much as her hand. I felt worse than I had when I had been trying to knock. Then there had been some shred of possibility. Now I was left with the reality. Too late. I descended the stairs back into the crowds and the noise. Then the noise seemed suddenly louder, and people were talking excitedly, some asking questions, others repeating rumours.
"A ship from the Out Islands."
"It's late to be docking. A narwhal banner?"
"The runner just went in. I saw his message baton."
Then I was trapped in a herd of folk crowding back toward the great hall. I tried to fight my way to the edge of the corridor, but only succeeded in being elbowed in the ribs, cursed at, and having my feet trodden on. I gave up and let the surge of eager folk carry me into the great hall. A runner had indeed just reached the queen. It took some little time for awareness of this to settle on the room. The musicians for the dance fell silent first, and then the puppeteers ceased their play. Jugglers stilled their clubs. The crowd hummed like a hive in anticipation, as more and yet more folk crowded into the room. The messenger stood before the queen, panting still. His baton that signalled to all that he was a royal messenger and not to be delayed, still clasped in his hand. In a moment, Chade was at Catrican's side, and then the prince was climbing the dais to stand beside her. She held out the open scroll so that they both might read it. Then, when she held it aloft, the murmurs and speculation died to near silence.
"Good tidings. A ship with the narwhal emblem has docked in the harbour," she announced. "It seems that perhaps Kaempra Peotr of the narwhal clan of the Out Islands will join us for our harvest fest tomorrow."
It was wonderful news, and Archon Bloodblade's shout of enthusiasm was easily heard above the polite mutters of the dukes and duchesses. An Out-Islander slapped the Duke of Tilth on the back. The prince nodded his pleasure to the entire assembly, and then motioned to the musicians, who launched into a lively and celebratory tune. There was scarcely room to dance, yet folk seemed content to hop or sway in place to the merry tune. Then the crowding in the room eased a bit, as some folk fled it for fresh air or space, or a chance to spread the gossip further. The puppet show finished, and I saw Chivalry and Nettle gather up their smaller siblings and herd them from the room. Other youngsters were being shooed along as well. Just when I thought that the crowd had eased enough that I could gracefully leave without resorting to elbows to get through the door, a second wave of excited voices reached us from outside. Almost immediately, folk began to spill back into the room. I felt someone tug at my sleeve, and turned to find Lacey standing there.
"Come sit with us, lad. We'll hide you."
And so I soon found myself on a bench between Patience and Lacey, looking as unostentatious as a fox in the henhouse. I slumped my shoulders and hid my face behind a mug of fresh cider, and waited to see what the fresh hubbub was about. It was Peotr arriving, I thought, when I saw him standing still in the door. And yet the noise outside seemed greater than that would occasion, and Peotr himself had a determined look on his face that bespoke something momentous. He lifted both arms over his head and cried out loudly,
"Clear a way, if you will. Clear a path."
It was easier said than done in the crowded space, and yet folk tried to give way.
He walked in first, setting a measured tread, and then behind him came a vision such as few have ever seen. Eliania wore a hooded blue cloak. The hood was lined with white fur that set off her shining black eyes and hair. The cloak itself was floor length and trailed some little distance in a train. It was buck blue and worked all over with bucks and narwhals leaping side by side. Tiny glittering white gems made up their eyes so that it seemed she wore a summer evening sky as she advanced into the room. Prince Dutiful had remained upon the dais with his mother. Now he looked down on her, and no one in the room could doubt that he beheld her with delight. He did not say a word to either Chade or the Queen, nor did he bother with the two steps, but leapt straight to the floor. At sight of him, Eliania threw back her hood and then ran to meet him. They met in the centre of the great hall. As they clasped hands, her clear and joyous voice carried,
"I could not wait. I could not wait for winter, and I could not wait for spring. I am here to marry you, and I will do my best to live according to your ways, strange though they are."
The prince looked down at her. I saw his face light with joy, and then I saw his hesitation. I saw him groping for what he must say, for what was correct for him to say before all his gathered people. Eliania looked up at him, and the light in her face began to dim as Dutiful attempted to compose a careful reply. I skilled fiercely.
"Tell her you cannot wait either. Tell her you love her, and that you will wed her right away.
Love that comes so far and at such a price should not be put off. A woman needs to be loved now." Chade's face froze in a smile of horror. The Queen stood, and I knew she held her breath. Piotr stood motionless, and his face was very still. I knew he prayed the prince would not hurt or humiliate the girl. Dutiful spoke loud and clear.
"Then we shall wed. Within the week. Not just before my dukes, but before all gathered here. We shall wed, and we shall bring in the harvest as man and wife. Would that please you?"
"El and Eda, the sea and the land,"
Bloodblade shouted.
"The buck and the narwhal, at the turning of the year, good fortune to us all."
"So it would be,"
Piotr cried out, and a sort of wonder came into his face.
"That would please me,"
I saw the words formed by her lips, but did not hear them. Noise had erupted all about me as hundreds of tongues clattered at once. Chade closed his eyes for a moment, then put on a smile and looked with apparent fondness at his impulsive, impetuous prince. Yet the secret sourness of his gaze was defeated and nullified by what shone in Eliania's eyes. If she had ever needed confirmation of her decision, Dutiful had given it. I wondered at what cost to herself and to her clan she had come here. The garment she wore bore both narwhals and bucks, and I doubted she had made it entirely herself. So I deduced some maternal support of her decision.
"They're getting married this week?"
Patience asked me, and I nodded in response.
"This will be a harvest fest to remember,"
she observed.
"Best send runners out about the countryside. No one will want to miss this. We haven't had a proper wedding in Buckkeep since Chivalry and I married here."
"I don't think this will be one now. They've prepared for harvest fest, not a wedding. Cook's going to be very upset,"
Lacey warned us. She was right, of course. I was able to retreat from the chaos I'd created, and actually found a few hours of sleep that night, holed up in the workroom. I fear few others did. The servants worked through the night. It was fortunate they had the feast for the harvest well begun, and the castle already decked with autumn garlands. Fortunate, too, that the princes, dukes, and duchesses had already convened for harvest fest, for it would have caused a greater furore if the prince's haste to wed had caused one of his high nobles to miss the ceremony. I almost missed my peephole the next day. I stood through the lengthy harvest ceremony in the back row of the prince's guard. Longwick had replenished our depleted ranks, yet even so I was painfully aware of the absence of those who had gone to find the dragon with us. Riddle stood beside me, and I think he felt it as keenly as I did.
Yet for all that there was satisfaction in watching our prince and his bride. They were arrayed as the king and queen of the harvest. Long had it been since that old custom was observed. For long had it been since we had had a royal couple in residence. The seamstresses must have worked throughout the night. Eliania wore her cloak of narwhals and bucks, and somehow a doublet that matched it perfectly had been created for the prince. Dutiful's simple coronet had been replaced with an ornate harvest crown, and in that I saw Chade's subtle hand, for he displayed the prince as a crowned king before his dukes. Ceremonial it might be, yet it could not fail to leave an impression. Eliania was crowned as well. Whereas the prince wore a crown of gilded antlers, hers featured a single narwhal horn, enamelled in blue and trimmed in silver. When they danced together, alone in the centre of the sanded floor, they looked like a couple from a legend sprung to life. "Like Edda and Eld themselves," Riddle observed, and I nodded to myself. Nobility and commoners are alike swayed by pomp and pageantry. Over the next few days the castle and the town swelled with folk, as it had not in years. The ceremony to honour the prince's witch-coterie was well attended, with far more folk than it would have ordinarily attracted. Cockle had the telling of the tale, and he acquitted himself well, and with far more accuracy than I had come to expect of minstrels. Perhaps because he was witted himself, he did not wish to be seen as embroidering the truth beyond what it would bear. So he told the tale with moving simplicity that made little of the type of magic Burrick and the coterie used, and much that they had been willing to sacrifice all for their prince. Cockle, Swift, Webb, and Sybil were formally recognised as the prince's witch coterie. There was some small grumbling at that, as other nobles recalled well that once the word had only been applied to the circle of skilled ones who aided a king. Chade assured them that there would, indeed, eventually be a skill coterie as well, as soon as suitable candidates could be tested and selected. The Queen conveyed Withywood to Molly, rather than Nettle, so that it might be seen as granted to Burrick's line in token of his service. Molly accepted it gravely, and I knew that the monies from that estate would provide well for her and all her children. Lady Nettle was presented as the newest of the Queen's circle of ladies, and Swift officially apprenticed to the Witmaster Webb. Webb spoke briefly but strongly of the power of Burrick's magic, and bemoaned that the man had been forced to hide it rather than educate his son in it. He hoped there would never be such a waste of talent again. Then Webb solved for me the riddle that he had given me when first we set out on the voyage. For he said that Burrick briefly rallied before he died, enough to bid his son farewell, and to die with the warrior's prayer on his lips. For, yes, he had sighed on his dying breath. And all knew that was the ultimate prayer one could offer to life. Acceptance. I pondered that during the evening when I sat in my workroom. My hands were slick with lamp oil. It had spread through the skill scrolls, making many of the old letters fuzzy and swollen to my weary eyes. It was a discouraging, tiresome task. I pushed the scroll away from me, wiped my hands on a rag, and poured myself a little more brandy. I was not certain I agreed with Webb's thoughts, and yet it seemed to me that yes had been Burrick's word for life. Certainly there seemed to be very little glory or satisfaction in saying no to it. I had said it often enough to have felt fully the truth of that. I had sought in vain for another opportunity to speak to Molly alone. Always she seemed surrounded by her children. Slowly it came to me, sitting there alone by my fire, that they were a part of her. Likely there would be very little chance of finding her alone and apart from them. The opportunity I had so long denied myself was here and now, but rapidly slipping away from me. The next morning, on the eve of the wedding, I went to the steams early in the day. I washed myself and shaved more carefully than I had in years. Back in the tower room I brushed my hair back into a warrior's tail and then took out the selection of clothing that the fool had inflicted on me. I dressed slowly, in the blue doublet and the white shirt, finishing it with the buck-blue leggings. I was now definitely a buckman, but no longer looked like servant or guardsman. I looked at myself in the mirror and smiled ruefully. Patience would approve. I looked dangerously like my father's son. I dared myself, and then moved the silver fox pin from the inside of my doublet to the outside. The little fox winked at me, and I smiled back.
I left the secret labyrinth and walked through the corridors of Buckkeep Castle. Several times I felt eyes on me, and once a man stopped dead before me and squinting at me with a frown as if struggling to remember something. I passed him by. The castle was a crawl with hastening servants and nobles socializing with one another. I made my way to the violet chamber and knocked firmly. Nettle opened the door. I had not been prepared for that, thinking that young chivalry would have been the first I must confront. She stared at me, and then recognized me with a visible start. She said nothing until I asked, "May I come in? I would speak to your mother and brothers."
"I don't think that's wise. Go away," she said, and began to shut the door, but chivalry caught the edge of it, asking her,
"Who is it?" And then, in an aside to me, "Don't mind her, sir. Dress of a lady and manners of a fishwife."
The room seemed full of children. I had never before realized how many 7 children were. Swift and Nimble were sitting on the floor, by the hearth, a game of stones spread out before them, with Steady watching the play. Swift looked up, saw me, and his mouth opened in an O of surprise. I saw his twin poke him, demanding,
"What is it? It's your turn."
Hearth and Just, wrestling on the bed, ignored me. I suddenly realized the size of the promise that Burrick had demanded of me. It was easily 7 times what chivalry had asked of him when he handed me over to his right-hand man to raise. The blankets were rucked about the tussling youngsters on the bed, and the candelabrum on the night-table was in obvious danger of being overset. And then, before Nettle could shut the door on me or chivalry invite me in, Molly entered from the adjoining chamber. She halted, staring at me. I think she would have thrown me out if she'd had the chance. Hearth stood up on the bed and made a spring for his brother, who evaded him by rolling away. I took 2 swift steps and caught the 6-year-old before he hit the floor. He wriggled away from me immediately, charging back into battle with his brother. They suddenly reminded me of a litter of puppies, and I smiled as I said, "I promised Burrick that I would look after his sons. I can't do that if I don't know them. I've come to introduce myself." Swift stood up slowly to face me. The question in his eyes was plain. I took a breath. I found my answer. "Yes. My name is Fitzchivalry Farseer. I grew up in the stables of Buckkeep. Your father taught me all the things he thought a man should know. I would pass that on to his sons." Chivalry had caught Nettle's uneasiness, and the name unsettled him even more. He moved to put his body between the smaller children and me. It was so instinctive of him that I had to smile, even when he said, "I think I can pass my father's teaching on to my brothers, sir." "I expect that you will, but you will have other things to think of as well. Who cares for your stock and stables right now when you are all away? Oxworthy, a man from our village who used to come to help out with the heavy work from time to time. He can manage it well enough, for a few days, though I will have to return to our holdings right after the prince's wedding."
"It's not his business,"
Nettle interjected indignantly. I knew I had to face her down or let her drive me off. "I made a promise, Nettle. Swift witnessed it. I do not think your father would have asked that of me unless he wished the raising of his small sons to be my business. That sets it out of your hands."
"But not out of mine," Molly interjected firmly. "And for many reasons I think this is unwise."
I took a breath and steeled my will. I turned to look at chivalry. "I love your mother. I have for years before she chose your father. Yet I promise you, I will not try to take his place with any of you, only to do what he asked of me, to look after you all." I looked back at Molly. Her face was so white I thought she would faint. "No secrets," I told her. "No secrets among us." Molly sat down heavily on the bed. Her 2 youngest boys immediately came to her, Hearth climbing into her lap. She put her arms around him reflexively.
"I think you had better go," she said faintly.
Steady came to his mother and put a protective arm around her. Swift stood suddenly.
"No secrets? Will you tell them that you are witted, then?"
It was a challenge. I smiled at him. "I believe you just did that for me." I took a breath and looked at Nettle.
I will also be instructing your sister in the skill. At Chivalry's blank look, I said, The king's magic, the old magic. She has it. She talks with dragons. You should chat with her about it sometime. It was why she was first brought here to Buckkeep, to serve her prince. I believe your father had some ability in the skill, for he served as king's man to king-in-waiting Chivalry, the man for whom your eldest brother is named. Swift was staring at me uncertainly.
Webb said we were not to speak of who you really were, that there were still some who'd like to see you dead, that your life was in our hands.
I bowed to him. Yes, I put my life in your hands. I looked at Nettle and added, If you truly like to be rid of me, it would be fairly simple for you.
Please, Fitz.
Molly sounded desperate.
Go. I need to speak to my children privately. I wish you had not given such a heavy secret to my younger ones. I scarcely trust them to wash their necks each day, let alone preserve such a confidence.
I felt a bit foolish then, and I bowed, saying only, As you will, Molly, and left. I got 5 steps past the closing of the door before my knees began to shake so badly that I had to lean up against the wall for a moment. A passing servant asked me if I was ill, but I assured her I would be fine. Yet as I found my strength and walked away down the corridor, I wondered if I would be. Then Nettle's sudden skilling hit me with the force of a mallet.
The dragons are coming! Tintaglia bids us have live meat waiting for them in the customary place.
It was good fortune that brought us dragons on the prince's wedding day, but Nettle's inspiration that the tribute Tintaglia had demanded so imperiously be referred to as the Dragon's Feast. Hapless steers, beribboned with blue streamers, were penned not far from the witness stones, awaiting their fate. Tintaglia and Icefire were not present for the ceremony itself, which was just as well. The well-wishers who came to witness the prince and Eliania make their vows in the centre of the witness stones crowded both hillsides. The couple was splendid in blue and white. They stood in the centre of the stones under a serendipitously blue sky and spoke their promises loudly and clearly. I was amongst the guards who stood in a line to keep an area near the cattle pens cleared for the dragons. They appeared as small jewels in the sky just as the prince had finished his promises to his bride and his dukes. They flew nearer, and the crowd oohed and aahed, as if they were an acrobatic troop brought especially for their pleasure. The dragons grew larger, and even larger, and soon we had no problems in keeping an area cleared for them to alight, as people began to realize the size of the creatures that were approaching. A hush came over the crowd, as it became apparent that Tintaglia fled the ardently pursuing Icefire. Above the witness stones, they wheeled and cavorted and mock-battled, swooping low enough that the wind of their wings tussled hair and flapped scarves. Together they soared, gleaming black and silvery blue, up in an abrupt, almost vertical climb, and then Icefire lunged and caught his mate. They coupled in a display of wanton lust that delighted the gathered witnesses as a good omen for their prince and new princess. No one with even a drop of the skill in them could have been completely immune to the passions of those great beasts. It infected the crowd with a wave of both sentiment and amorousness that made that evening's festivities a night long and fondly remembered by many. The dragons cared little for any of that. They coupled several times with loud trumpeting and mock challenges to one another, and then fell on the bullocks with a zeal for feeding that was horrifying to witness. The pens did not hold the panicky cattle, and one guardsman was trampled, and several dozen onlookers sent scrambling for safety before Tintaglia and Icefire completed their slaughter and settled in to feeding. That was bloody and messy enough that even those who had stayed behind to watch the dragons kill the cattle decided to go back to the castle, or to watch from a safer distance. Yet even though the dragons paid little attention to the occasion, their presence was a triumph for our prince. Before the dukes dispersed to their separate duchies, they met and agreed to recognize Dutiful as king-in-waiting. It was an end to Dutiful's quest worthy of any minstrel's song, and many were made about it, and sung often in the days to come.
The feasting and rejoicing in Buckkeep Castle went on for a full 20 days until the onset of wintry weather convinced the nobility that they ought to seek their own keeps and holdings before travel became completely unpleasant. The castle settled back, very gradually, into a routine. Yet for all that winter, it remained a livelier place than it had in many a year. The king-in-waiting and his young bride attracted not just the youthful nobility of the six duchies, but the younger Kaemperor of the Out-Islands. Alliances were made that had nothing to do with trade, and wedding plans set that spanned the two countries. Among those who announced their intentions were Lord Sybil and Lady Siddle. Yet it was a time of departures, too. I made farewell to Hap and his master, for they would follow their lord back to his keep for the winter. My boy seemed genuinely happy, and if I was not pleased to part with him, I was pleased that he had found a choice that gave him so much satisfaction. Webb took Swift off with him, saying it was time the boy got out and met more of his own folk, to understand better all the nuances of the wit, and to make him appreciate the necessity of using it with discipline. My declaration of love for his mother had raised a new wall between Swift and me. I was not sure it was one I could soon breach, and yet I felt better knowing that I had spoken honestly to him. Webb tried to talk me into going with them, saying that I too would benefit, but I begged off yet again, promising that truly, truly, one day I would make time. He smiled, and reminded me that no man could make time, but only use that which he was given wisely. I promised him I'd try to do that, and waved them farewell from the gates of Buckkeep. The dragons departed with the first frost, and we were not sorry to bid them farewell. They were each capable of eating a couple of cattle a day. Nettle warned us early in their visit that if we did not supply them willingly, they would likely take whatever they fancied. Our herds and flocks were well culled before the chill of winter drove them south. I was amused one night to become aware of Nettle and Tintaglia in dream talk. Nettle dream-rode with Tintaglia. She flew slightly behind Icefire, heading south as they flew through the night. The sweep of cool wind, the stars overhead, and the rich smells of the slumbering earth below were intoxicating.
"And beyond that desert you will find some of the richest, fattest herds in this part of the world, or so I have heard."
Nettle was casual with her recommendation.
"Desert? Dry sand? I have been longing for a good dust bath. Wet sand clings beneath my scales, and water cannot polish old blood from one's scales like sand does."
"I think you will find much there to your liking. I have heard that the cattle of Chalced are easily twice the size of what we raise here, and so fat that the meat catches fire if you try to cook it over an open flame."
Nettle's dream was rich with the smell of roasting meat and dripping fat. It almost made me hungry. "I have never heard of the cattle of Chalced being exceptionally fat or large," I objected.
"We were not conversing with you," Nettle pointed out severely, "and what I know of Chalced I know from my father's stories of that place. I think they would profit much from a visit from hungry dragons."
And then she tumbled me out of her dream, and I awoke on the floor by my bed. Dutiful, Chade, Nettle, Thick, and I continued to meet in early mornings to study and expand our understanding of the skill. Nettle was courteous, but spoke to me only as it was necessary. I did not push against that wall either, but instructed Dutiful, Thick, and her as a group. Soon my paltry advantage over them was apparent, and we proceeded to learn as a coterie. What we learned from the recovered scrolls made us go more slowly rather than more quickly, for it rapidly became apparent that we wielded our magic like a boy wields a sword, with little understanding of either the danger or the potential of it. Chade desperately wished to experiment with the portal stones, as we began to call them. The elderling cities and their hints of both treasure and secrets enticed him. Only the extreme aversion that both Thick and I evinced towards them convinced him that we should wait until he had a better mastery of the magic before attempting such a thing. Perhaps the most positive outgrowth of it was that Chade agreed that in spring he would arrange a calling after the old tradition, and that from among those who came we would select skill candidates who would be trained according to the careful procedures outlined in the scrolls. Despite my duties, winter dragged for me. The day after the wedding, Molly and five of her sons had departed Buckkeep.
She did not bid me farewell in any way. I bled inside for 3 days, and then, lacking all other advisers in matter of the heart, took my sorry account of my foolishness to Patience and Lacey. They listened carefully, praised my courage and honesty, condemned my stupidity, and then revealed that Molly had already told them the whole story. After chiding me for rushing in just as they had warned me not to do, Patience announced that I had best return to Tradeford with her for the winter, to keep myself busy, and to give Molly some time. I narrowly begged my way out of that, yet bidding them farewell was difficult for me, and I promised I would come to visit before the year was out.
"If we're still alive,"
Patience conceded cheerfully. They promised to send me a monthly missive, along with the report of the holdings that they sent to the Queen, and I promised to do likewise. I watched them set forth, mounted on horses amidst the guard the Queen had insisted on sending with them, for despite their years they both disdained the comforts of a litter. I stood in the road, staring after them, until a curve in the road took them out of sight.
Chapter 37 Ever After. Let the calling be announced well in advance, for people deserve a warning before the skill magic touches them for the first time. A calling, issued with no warning, can induce great fear, for some who hold the potential for skill will not know what it is, and fear that madness, or worse, has come upon them. So let riders be sent out well ahead of time, but do not tell when the exact day of the calling will go forth. In the past, much time has been wasted trying to wake the skill in some who came to Buckkeep, claiming to have heard the call, when in fact all they wished to do was escape a life as farmers or bakers or rivermen. Let the strongest coterie in the keep issue the call, making it as far-reaching as possible. A calling should be held no more often than every 15 years. Treacney's On the Calling of Candidates. I tried, but I could not help myself. 1 month after Patience had departed, I gave in to an impulse. I sent a large pot of preserved wintergreen berries to Molly. I approached Riddle to act as my messenger. He seemed surprised that I even asked if he were busy, commenting that he had been told several weeks ago to consider himself at my disposal. Chade had undertaken a number of small changes on my behalf since I'd begun to take a more active role in Farseer matters. The pretense that I was an ordinary member of the Prince's Guard was fading, replaced with the unseen acceptance that I served the royal family in more confidential ways. Nominally, I was still Tom Badgerlock, but I seldom wore the livery of a guard anymore, and the fox pin rode always on my breast. Riddle seemed bemused by the errand I gave him, but carried the gift and delivered it nonetheless. "What did she say?" I asked him anxiously when he returned. He looked at me blankly. "She said nothing to me. I gave it to the lad who came to the door, but I told him it was for his mum. Isn't that what you wanted me to do?" I hesitated, and then said, "Yes, that was exactly right. Yes." The next month I sent a missive saying that I thought Nettle was doing very well with her studies, and becoming more comfortable at court. I told the family that Webb had sent a bird to inform us that he and Swift would likely winter with the Duke and Duchess of Burns. Webb seemed well pleased with the boy, and I thought Molly would wish to know that they were well and doing fine. My letter spoke only of her children. Along with the missive I sent 2 jumping jacks and a carved bear, and a sack of horehound candies. Riddle's report from that delivery was slightly more encouraging. One of the little fellows said the horehound was good, but not as good as peppermint. The next month, a sack of horehound and a sack of peppermint candies, as well as nuts and raisins, accompanied my letter about Nettle. That won me a brief reply from Molly, written on the bottom of my own letter, saying she welcomed news of Nettle, but would I kindly stop attempting to make the boys sick with sweets. The next month's letter duly reported on Nettle and gave news of Swift, who had taken the blotch fever along with all the other youngsters at Ripplekeep and Bairns, but had recovered well and seemed none the worse for it. The Duchess herself had taken an interest in the lad and was teaching him much about hawks. Personally, I wondered how much, but left that speculation out of my letter. Instead of sweets, I sent 2 pouches of baked clay marbles
an exceptionally nice hoofpick in a leather sheath, and two wooden practice swords. Riddle was amused to report that Harth had clouted Just with one of the swords before he had even got off his horse, and refused to trade with Nimble for the bag of marbles that had been intended for him. I took it as a good sign that Riddle knew the boys by name now, and that they had all come out of the house to greet him. The note from Molly was less heartening. Just had suffered a considerable lump to the back of his head, for which she blamed me. The boys had also been disappointed at the lack of sweets with the letter, for which she also blamed me. The letters were welcome, but I should stop disrupting her family with inappropriate gifts. There was also a note from Chivalry, stiffly thanking me for the hoofpick. He asked if I knew of a source of saff oil, for one of the mares had a stubborn infection in one hoof, and he thought he recalled his father using saff oil. I did not wait a month. I found saff oil immediately, and sent it back to Chivalry, with instructions to wash out all her hooves with vinegar, move her into a different stall, and then apply saff oil to all four hooves, inside and out. I further suggested that he put a good bed of hearth ash down in her old stall and leave it there for 3 days before sweeping it out, and then mopping the stall with vinegar and letting it dry well before stabling any other horses in it. And with the saff oil and letter to Chivalry, I defiantly sent barley sugar sticks, with the request that he ration them out so that no one suffered from belly aches. He returned a note, thanking me for the oil and saying he had forgotten about the vinegar portion of the remedy. He asked if I knew the correct proportions for a certain liniment that Burrick used to make, for his attempt at it had come out too runny, and he assured me that the barley sugar would only be distributed as it was earned. Molly sent a note, but it was clearly marked, to Nettle.
But Steady told me that they had actually all liked the peppermint better,
Riddle informed me as he gave me Chivalry's missive.
Steady seems to me to be the quiet one, you know, the good lad who's often overlooked amongst rowdier boys.
With a liar's grin, he added, I was like that myself as a lad. Surely you were, I agreed, sceptically.
Any response? Riddle asked me, and I told him I needed some time to think about it.
It took me several days of experiments at the work table to compound correctly the liniment. It made me realize how much I had forgotten. I made several pots of it and sealed them well. Chade paid one of his rare visits to the old workroom we once had shared. He sniffed the air speculatively and asked what I was concocting.
Bribes, I answered him honestly.
Ah, he said, and when he asked no more, I knew that Riddle was still reporting to him as well. Made a few changes up here, I see, he added, looking about the room. Mostly with a broom and some water. I'd give a great deal to have a window. He gave me an odd look. The room next to this one is always left empty. It used to belong to Lady Time. I understand there are rumours she haunts it still. Strange odours, you know, and sounds in the night. He grinned to himself. She was a useful old hag. I bricked up the connecting door years and years ago. It used to be behind that wall hanging. You could probably knock through the wall if you went about it quietly.
Knock through the wall quietly?
It might be a bit difficult.
A bit.
I may try it. I'll let you know.
Or you could move Nettle out of your old room down below and have the use of it.
I shook my head. I still hope there may come a time when she would want to use that passage to come up and talk with me of an evening. But not much progress there yet.
No, I'm afraid not.
Ah, she's as hard-headed as you were. Don't trust her near the mantel with a fruit knife. I looked at the one that still stood there, driven in as deep as my boyish anger could sink it.
I'll remember that.
Remember, too, that you forgave me. Eventually. I tried to send off the liniment by Riddle with a sack of peppermint drops, some spiced tea, and a small marionette of a deer.
That won't do, he told me. At least put in some tops, so there's something for each of them.
And so it was done. He suggested penny whistles as well, quite innocently, but I pointed out I was trying to win my way in, not provoke Molly to murder me. He grinned, nodded, and rode off, and stayed away an extra 2 days because of a snowstorm. He brought back letters, one for me and one for Nettle, and the news that he'd eaten with the family and spent the night in the stables after a half dozen games of stones with Steady each evening.
I spoke you well, when chivalry asked after you. Said you spent your nights at your scroll work, and were fair to turn into a scribe if you didn't watch yourself. So then Harth asked, "What, is he fat then? For I gather the scribe at their town is quite a portly man." So I said no, quite the opposite, that I thought you'd lost flesh and grown quieter of late, and that you spent more time alone than was healthy for any man. I tilted my head at him. Could you have made me sound any more pathetic? He mimicked the tip of my head. Is there any of it not true? The note was from Chivalry, thanking me for the liniment and recipe. I don't know what was in Molly's note to Nettle. The next morning she lingered after the skill lesson. Dutiful called to ask if she was coming, for he and Eliania and Civil and Siddle intended to go riding, if she'd care to come. She told him to go ahead and she would catch up easily, for it didn't take her forever to primp her hair before riding out. She turned back to catch me, smiling, and said, "I speak him formal when others are about. It's only here that I talk to him like that." He likes it. He was elated when he first discovered he had a cousin. He said it was nice to know a girl who spoke her mind to him. That stopped her cold, and I regretted the remark, for I thought I had put her off whatever it was she was about to say. But she met my eyes, and lifting her chin, set her fists to her hips. "Oh, and should I speak my mind to you?" I wasn't sure. "You could," I suggested. "My mother writes that she is well, and that my little brothers quite enjoy Riddle's visits. She wonders if you are afraid of my brothers that you don't come yourself." I slouched back in my chair and looked down at the tabletop. I'm more likely to be afraid of her. Time was she had quite a temper. I picked at my thumbnail. "Time was, I understand, you were excellent at provoking it." "I suppose that is true. Do you think she would welcome a visit from me?" She stood quite a time, not answering. Then she asked, "And are you afraid of my temper as well?" "A bit," I admitted. "Why do you ask?" She walked to Verity's window and stared out over the sea as she used to. In that pose, she looked as much a farseer as I did. She ran her hands back through her hair distractedly. Truly, she could have given a bit more care to primping. Her shortened hair stood up like the hair on an angry cat's back. "Once, I thought we were going to be friends. Then I discovered that you were my father. From that moment on, you haven't much tried even to speak to me." "I thought you didn't want me to. Perhaps I wanted to see how hard you try." She turned back to look at me accusingly. "You didn't try at all." I sat a long time in silence. She turned and started towards the door. I stood up. "You know, Nettle, I was raised by a man among men. Sometimes I think that is the greatest disadvantage a man can have when it comes to dealing with women." She turned and looked back at me. I spoke from the heart. "I don't know what to do. I want you to at least know me as a person. Barrick was your father, and he did well at it. Perhaps it's too late for me to have that place in your life, nor can I find a place in your mother's life for me. I love her still just as much as I did when she left me. I thought then that, when all my tasks were done, I would find her and somehow we would be happy together. And here we are, 16 years later, and I still haven't managed to find my way back to her." She stood, her hand on the door, looking uncomfortable. Then she said, "Perhaps you are telling these things to the wrong woman." And she slipped quietly out of it, letting it close behind her. A few days later, Riddle found me at the guard's table, eating breakfast. He slid onto the bench opposite me. "Nettle has given me a letter to deliver to her mother and brothers. She said to take it whenever I made my next journey for you." He reached across the table and took a hunk of bread from my plate. He bit into it and asked with his mouth full, "Will that be soon?" I thought about it. "Tomorrow morning," I suggested. He nodded. "I thought it might be about then." I rode my black down to the market in Buckkeep Town, chaffering with her all the way. She had had half a year with a stable boy whose idea of exercising her was to take her out and let her run as much as she wanted and then bring her back.
She was wilful and rude, tugging at her bit and ignoring the rain. I was ashamed of myself for neglecting her. I visited the winter market and rode home with sugared ginger and 2 arm lengths of red lace. I put them in a basket with a purloined bottle of dandelion wine. I sat all night with a piece of good paper in front of me and managed to find 3 sentences. I remember you in red skirts. You climbed up the beach cliffs in front of me, and I saw your bare, sandy ankles. I thought my heart would leap out of my chest. I wondered if she would even remember that long-ago picnic when I had not even dared to kiss her. I sealed the note with a blotch of wax. 4 times I unsealed it, trying to think of better words. Eventually I entrusted it to Riddle as it was, and walked about for the next 4 days wishing I hadn't. On the 4th night I worked the lever that opened the door in Nettle's bedchamber. I did not go in and summon her, as Chade had me. Instead I went halfway down those steep steps and left a candle burning there. Then I went back up and waited. The wait seemed to last forever. I do not know which wakened her at last, the light or the draught, but I finally heard her hesitant tread on the stair. I had built up the fire well in the comfortable end of the room. She peered round the corner of the concealed door, saw me, but still came in cautious as a cat. She walked slowly past the work-table with the stained scrolls stretched out on it, and more slowly past the work-hearth with its racks of tongs and measures and stained pans. She came at last to the chairs by the fireside. She had on a nightgown and a woven shawl across her shoulders. She was shivering. "Sit down," I invited her, and she did, slowly. "This is where I work," I told her. The kettle was just on the boil, and I asked her, "Would you like a cup of tea?"
"In the middle of the night?"
"I do a lot of my work in the middle of the night."
"Most people sleep, then."
"I am not like most people."
"That's so."
She stood up and studied the items on the mantel above the hearth. There was a carving of the wolf that the fool had done, and next to it the memory stone with a similar image turned face out. She touched the handle of the fruit knife embedded there and gave me a puzzled glance. Then she reached up and set her hand to the hilt of Chivalry's sword. "You can take it down if you like. It was your grandfather's. Be careful, it's heavy." She took her hand away.
"Tell me about him."
"I can't."
"Is it another secret, then?"
"No. I can't tell you because I never knew him. He gave me to Burick when I was 5 or 6. I never saw him, that I can recall. I believe he looked in on me with the skill from time to time, through Verity's eyes. But I knew nothing of that, then."
"It sounds like you and me,"
she said, slowly. "Yes, it does," I admitted, "except that I have a chance to know you now, if we are both bold enough to take it."
"I'm here,"
she pointed out, settling deeper into the chair. And then she fell silent, and I could not think of anything to say. Then she pointed at the fool's carving.
"Is that your wolf? Night Eyes?"
"Yes." She smiled.
"He looks exactly like I thought you would. Tell me more about him."
And so I did. Riddle returned 3 days later, complaining of bad roads and the cold. A storm had followed him home. I scarcely heard him. I took the little roll of bark paper he offered me and carried it carefully up to my lair before I opened it. At first glance it looked like a drawing. Then I realized it was a hastily sketched map. There were only a few words on the bottom of the page. "Nettle said you were having a hard time finding your way back to me. Perhaps this will help." A deep wet snow was falling outside Buckkeep Castle. The clouds were heavy. I did not expect it would stop soon. I went to my workroom and stuffed a change of clothing into a saddlebag. I skilled to Chade, "I'll be gone for a while." "Very well. We can finish working on that scroll translation tonight." "You misunderstand me. I'll be gone 7 days at least. I'm going to Molly." He hesitated, and I could feel how badly he wanted to object. There was too much going on for me to leave. There were translations,
the refinement of his powder that I'd been helping him with, and the calling to arrange. The scrolls cautioned that the people of the kingdom had to be prepared for the calling, lest parents or friends think those who heard voices in their heads were going mad. Yet it also cautioned that the exact day of the calling be kept secret, to prevent charlatans from wasting the time of the skillmaster. Irritably, I pushed such considerations aside. I waited. "Go, then, and good luck. Have you told Nettle?" Now it was my turn to hesitate. "I've told only you. Do you think I should tell her?"
"The things you ask my advice on, never the ones I hope you'll ask me about, always the ones that..." "Never mind. Yes, tell her, only because not telling her might seem deceptive."
So I reached out to my daughter and said, "Nettle, I've had a note from Molly. I'm going to go visit her." And then the obvious occurred to me. "Do you want to go along?"
"It's storming outside, with worse to come by the look of it. When are you leaving?"
"Now."
"It isn't wise."
"I've never been wise." The words echoed oddly in my mind, and I smiled.
"Go then. Dress warmly."
"I shall. Farewell." And I went. My black was not pleased at being taken from her warm, dry stall to face the storm. It was a cold, wet, and tedious journey. The one inn I stopped at was full of trapped travellers, and I had to sleep on the floor near the hearth wrapped in my cloak. The next night, a farmer allowed me to shelter in his barn overnight. The storm did not let up, and the journey only became more unpleasant, but I pushed on. Luck had it that the snow would stop, and the clouds blow clear one valley before I reached Burrick's holding. As I pushed my black down the buried road towards the house, the place looked like something out of a tale. Snow was heaped on cottage and stable roof. Smoke curled up from the chimney into the blue sky. A path was already warm between the house and the barns. I pulled in my black and sat looking down on it. As I watched, Chivalry opened a barn door and then trundled out a barrow of dirty straw. I whistled to give him warning of a visitor, and then rode my black down the hill. He stood, unmoving, watching me come. In the yard before the house, I pulled her in and sat still, trying to think of a greeting. My black tugged twice at her bit, and then threw her head back irritably. "That horse wants training," Chivalry observed with disapproval. He came closer, then stopped.
"Oh, it's you."
"Yes." The hard words. "May I come in?" He might be barely 15, but he was the man of these holdings now.
"Of course."
But there was no smile with the words. "I'll take your horse for you." "I'd rather put her up myself, if you don't mind. I've neglected her, and it shows. I'll need to handle her a lot to undo it."
"As you will. This way."
I dismounted and glanced toward the cottage, but if anyone inside was aware of me, it did not show. I led my black and followed Chivalry into a well-ordered stable. Nimble and Just were mucking out stalls. Steady came in carrying buckets of water. They all halted at the sight of me. I suddenly felt surrounded, and the ghost of a memory floated to the surface of my mind. Night Eyes, standing at the outskirts of the pack's gathering, wanting to go in so badly, but knowing that if he approached them the wrong way, they would drive him out.
"I see your father's hands everywhere here," I said. And it was true. I knew at once that Burrick had built this building to meet his own demands. The stalls were larger than the ones at Buckkeep. When the storm shutters were opened, air and light would flood in. I saw Burrick in the way the brushes were stored, and the tack put up. I could almost feel him here.
I blinked and came back to myself, suddenly aware of Chivalry watching me.
"You can put her in there," he said, gesturing to a stall. They went about their work as I cared for my black. I watered her and grained her lightly, and left her clean and dry. Chivalry came to look over the door of the stall at her, and I wondered if my work would pass his inspection.
"Nice horse," was all he said.
"Yes, she was a gift from a friend. The same one who sent Malta to your father when he knew he wouldn't need her any more."
"Now there's a mare," Chivalry exclaimed, and I followed him down the stalls to look at her. I saw Brusk, a four-year-old stallion out of Ruddy that chivalry had wanted to use to stud her. And I visited Ruddy. I think the old stallion almost remembered me. He came and rested his head against my shoulder for a time. He was old and getting tired. "This will probably be the last foal he sires," I said quietly. "I think that's why Burrick wanted to use him. One last chance to get that cross of bloodlines. He was a fine stud in his day." "I remember when he first came. Barely. Some woman came down the hill with two horses and just gave them to my father. We didn't even have a barn then, let alone a stable. Papa moved all the wood out of the woodshed that night so the horses wouldn't be left outside." I'll bet Ruddy was glad to see him. Chivalry gave me a puzzled look. "You didn't know Ruddy was your father's horse long before that. Verity gave him the pick of the two-year-olds. He chose Ruddy. He'd known this horse since the day his dam dropped him. The night the Queen had to flee Buckkeep for her life. Burrick put her on this horse. He carried her all the way to the mountains, safely." He was properly amazed. "I didn't know that. Papa didn't talk much about his days at Buckkeep." And so I ended up helping with the mucking out and the feeding before ever I went in to see Molly. I told stories of horses I had known, and chivalry walked me through the barns with pardonable pride. He'd done a good job of keeping it all up, and I told him so. He showed me the mare with the infected hoof, sound now, and then I walked through the shed to the milk cow and the dozen chickens. By the time chivalry led me back to the cottage with the lads trooping behind us, I felt I had acquitted myself well with them. "Mother, you've a visitor," chivalry called as he pushed open the door. I stamped snow and manure from my feet and followed him in. She had known I was out there. Her cheeks were pink, and her shortened hair smoothed back. She saw me looking at it and lifted a self-conscious hand to it. In that moment we were both reminded of why it was shortened, and Burrick's shadow stepped between us. "Well, chores are done, and I'm off to Staffman's," chivalry announced before I could even greet her.
"I want to go too. I want to see Kip and play with the puppies,"
Hearth announced. Molly bent down to the boy.
"You can't always go with chivalry when he goes to visit his sweetheart,"
she admonished him. "He can today," chivalry announced abruptly. He gave me a sideways glance, as if making sure I knew he was doing me a vast favour. "I'll put him up behind me. His pony can't deal with this snow. Hurry up and get ready."
"Would you like a cup of tea, Fitz? You must be cold."
"Actually, there's nothing like stable chores for warming a man after a long ride. But yes, I would."
"The boys put you to work in the stable? Oh, Shiv, he's a guest."
"He knows his way around a shovel," chivalry said, and it was a compliment. Then, "Hurry up, Hearth, I'm not going to wait all day for you." There were a few moments of noisy chaos that seemed necessary for preparing a six-year-old boy to going anywhere, for no one but me was astonished at it. It made the guard's mess seem a calm place by comparison. By the time the two were out of the door, Steady had already retreated to the loft, while Just and Nimble had seated themselves at the table. Nimble pretended to be cleaning his nails, while Just stared at me, frankly.
"Fitz, please sit down. Nimble, move your chair over, make room. Just, I could do with more kindling."
"You're just sending me out to get me out of the way."
"How perceptive of you. Now go. Nimble, you may help him. Clear some of the snow from the woodstack and move some of it into the woodshed to dry."
They both went out, but not quietly or graciously. When the door had closed behind them, Molly took a deep breath. She removed a kettle from the fire, poured hot water over spiced tea in a large pot, and then brought it to the table. She set out cups for us and a pot of honey. She sat down across from me.
"Hello,"
I said. She smiled.
"Hello."
I asked Nettle if she wanted to come with me, but she didn't want to ride through the storm.
"I can't blame her, and I think it's hard for her to come home sometimes. Things are far humbler here than at Buckkeep Castle."
"You could move to Withywoods. It's yours now, you know."
"I know."
A shadow passed over her face, and I wished I hadn't mentioned it.
but it would be too many changes too fast. The boys are still becoming accustomed to the idea that their father is never coming back. And, as you see, chivalry is courting.
He seems very young for that, I ventured.
He's a young man with a large holding. Another woman in the house would make things much easier for all of us. What should he wait for if he's found a woman who loves him? She countered.
When I had no answer to that, she added,
If they marry, I don't think Thrift will want to move far from her parents' home. She is very close to her sister.
I see. And I did. I suddenly saw that Molly was no longer someone's daughter to be whisked off from her father's house and become mine. She was the centre of a world here, with roots and ties.
Life is complicated, isn't it? She said to my silence.
I looked at her in her simple, sombre-hued robe. Her hands were no longer smooth and slender. There were lines in her face that had not been there when she was mine. Her body had softened and rounded with the years. She was no longer the girl in the red skirts running down the beach before me. I have never wanted anything so much in my life as I've always wanted you.
Fitz,
she exclaimed, glancing up at the loft, and I suddenly realized I had spoken the words aloud. Her cheeks glowed, and she lifted both hands to cover her mouth with her fingertips.
I'm sorry, I said. I know it's too soon, you've told me that, and I will wait. I'll wait however long you want me to wait. I just want to be sure you know that I am waiting.
I saw her swallow. She said huskily,
I don't know how long it will take.
It doesn't matter. I stretched out my hand, palm up, on the tabletop. She hesitated, and then set hers in it. And we sat, not speaking, until the boys came in with a load of snowy kindling to be scolded by their mother for not wiping their feet. I stayed until afternoon. We drank tea, and I talked about Nettle at the court, and told the boys stories of Burrick when he had been a younger man. I saddled my black and bid them farewell before chivalry and hearth returned. Molly walked out to say goodbye, and kissed me, on the cheek, and I rode 3 days back to Buckkeep Castle. Riddle continued to carry letters between her cottage and Buckkeep Castle. They all came up for Springfest, and I managed to dance with Molly once. It was the first time I had ever danced with her, and the first time I'd attempted to dance in years. I danced with Nettle afterwards, who advised me never to attempt it again. But she smiled as she said it. I saw Hap in the early days of spring. He and Sawtongue came through Buck at the beginning of their summer travels. Hap was taller and leaner and seemed content with his life. He'd seen a great deal of Bairns and was now off to Ripon and then Shokes. He'd made 2 songs of his own, both humorous, and both seemed well received when he sang them for us at the Lesser Hearth. Webb and Swift came back to Buckkeep later that month. Swift had widened through the shoulders and was more introspective than I recalled him. Webb stayed at Buckkeep while Swift went home to spend a week with his family. He returned with news that Chivalry would be getting married in 3 months. I went down for the wedding, watching him stand before Thrift and pledge himself to her while she blushed and smiled, scarcely able to look at him. Envy burned in me. It would be so simple for them. They met, they loved, they married. I suspected they'd have a baby in the cradle before the year was out, and I could get no closer to Molly than the touch of her hand and a kiss on the cheek. Summer grew strong and hot. It was a good summer. Eliania was pregnant, and the whole of the 6 duchies seemed abuzz with it. The crops seemed to grow before my eyes. My black learned the way to Molly's cottage and back. I helped Chivalry raise the beams on the extra rooms he was building, and watched Molly and Thrift cook companionably together. I watched her as she moved around the room at her simple tasks, watched her laugh and stir the soup and brush her lengthening hair back from her eyes. I had not been so fevered with desire since I was 15 years old. I could not sleep at night, and when I did, I had to ward my dreams. I could see Molly and speak to her, but it was always in Burrick's house, or with Burrick's sons clinging to her hands. There seemed no place in her world that I could claim, and I grew irritable with everyone.
I went to see Patience and Lacey, as I had promised, making the long journey in the hot and dusty days of high summer, and Chade swore I was so fractious that he was glad to be rid of me for a time. I didn't blame him. Lacey had become frailer, and Patience had hired two women to help care for her old servant. Walking in her gardens with Patience's worn hand on my arm, seeing how she had converted the bloody soil of Regal's King's Circle to a haven of greenery, beauty, and peace, gave me the first rest I had known in a long time. She gave me some of my father's things from her clutter, a plain sword belt he had preferred, letters Burrick had sent to him that mentioned me, and a jade ring. The ring fit my hand perfectly. I wore it home. Nettle lingered after our skill lesson the first morning I was back. Chade did also, but at a look from me, he sighed and left me alone with my daughter.
"You were gone a long time. Weeks," she said.
"I hadn't seen Patience in a long time, and she's getting old." She nodded.
"Thrift is pregnant. That's wonderful news." "It is. We're all very excited, but my mother says it makes her feel old to know she'll be a grandmother soon."
That gave me a moment's pause.
"She said to me, 'Time goes faster when you're older, Nettle.' Isn't that an odd thought?"
"I've known it for some time."
"Do you?
I think women know it better, perhaps." I looked at Nettle directly and said nothing.
"Perhaps not,"
she said then, and went away. 4 days later I saddled my black again and set out for Molly's. Chade sternly warned me that I must be back in time for the calling, and I promised him that I would be. The day was fine, and my black well-behaved and in good condition for the journey. The summer evenings were long, and I made the journey in 2 days instead of three. I found myself very welcome, for chivalry was replacing the posts in the paddock fence. Swift and Steady were helpful in pulling up the old rotted posts, and Just and Hearth dug the holes bigger. Chivalry and I came behind, setting each pole straight and tall. He spoke to me about becoming a father and how exciting it was, until he realized that my silences were growing longer and longer. Then he declared he was going to take the boys down to the creek and let them swim for a time, for he'd had enough of hot, sweaty work for the day. He asked if I'd come, but I shook my head. I was pouring a bucket of cool water from the well over my head when Molly came out with a basket on her arm.
"Thrift is napping. The heat is hard on her. It is when you're carrying. I thought we'd leave the house quiet for her and perhaps find if there are any blackberries ripe enough to be sweet yet."
We climbed the gentle hill behind the house. The shouts of the boys splashing in the creek below faded. We went past Molly's neat straw hives, gently humming with the warm day. The blackberry tangle was beyond them, and Molly led me to the far south side of it, saying the berries always ripened there first. Her bees were busy there too, some among the last blackberry flowers, and some after the juice from the bursting ripe fruit. We picked berries until the basket was half full. Then, as I bent a high prickly branch to bring it down so Molly could reach the top fruit, I offended a bee. It rushed at me, first tangling in my hair, and then bumbling down my collar. I slapped at it and cursed as it stung me. I stumbled back from the berry bushes, batting at two others that were suddenly buzzing round my head.
"Move away quickly,"
Molly warned me, and then came to take my hand and hurry me down the hill. A second one stung me behind the ear before they gave off the chase.
"And we've left the basket back there with all the berries. Shall I try to go back for it?" "Not yet. Wait a time until they settle. Here, don't rub that. The stinger is probably still in it. Let me see."
I sat down in the shade of an alder, and she bent my head forward to look at the sting behind my ear.
"It's really swelling, and you've pushed the stinger right in. Sit still now."
She picked at it with her fingers. I flinched, and she laughed.
"Sit still. I can't get it with my nails."
She leaned forward and put her mouth on it. I felt her tongue find a stinger, and then she gripped it between her teeth and pulled it out. She brushed it from her lips onto her fingers.
"See? You'd pushed it all the way in. Is there another one?"
"Down my back," I said, and in spite of myself my voice shook. She stopped and looked at me. She turned her head and looked again at me, as if she had not seen me in a long time.
Her voice was husky when she said, "Take your shirt off. I'll see if I can get it out." I felt dizzy as her mouth once again touched me. She presented me with the second stinger. Then she set her fingers to the arrow scar on my back and said, "What was this?" "An arrow. A long time ago." "And this?"
"That's more recent. A sword."
"My poor Fitz." She touched the scar between my shoulder and neck. "I remember when you got this one. You came to my bed still bandaged."
"I did." I turned to her, knowing that she was waiting for me. It still took all my courage. Very carefully, I kissed her. I kissed her cheeks, her throat, and finally her mouth. She tasted of blackberries. Over and over I kissed her, as slowly as I could, trying to kiss away all the years I had missed. I unlaced her blouse and lifted it over her head, bearing her to the blue summer sky above us. Her breasts were soft and heavy in my hands. I treasured them. Her skirt slipped away, a blown blossom on the grass. I lay my love down in the deep wild grasses and sweetly took her to me. It was homecoming and completion, and a marvel worth repeating. We dozed for a time, and then woke as the shadows were lengthening.
"We must go back," she exclaimed, but
"not yet," I told her. I claimed her again, as slowly as I could bear to, and my name, whispered by my ear as she shuddered beneath me, was the sweetest sound I'd ever heard. We were abruptly guilty adolescents as the raised cries of "Mother! Fitz!" reached our ears. We scrambled hastily back into our clothing. Molly ventured alone to retrieve our basket of berries. We dusted leaves and bits of grass from our hair, laughing breathlessly as we did so. I kissed her again.
"We have to stop,"
Molly warned me. She returned my kiss warmly, and then lifted her voice to call,
"I'm here! I'm coming!"
I took her hand in mine as we went round the bramble and held it as we strode back down the hill to her children. Epilogue. Withy Woods is a warm valley, centred on a gently flowing river that carves a wide plain that nestles between gently rising and rolling foothills. It is a wonderful place to grow grapes and grain and bees and young boys. The manor is of timber rather than stone, and there are times when this still seems very strange to me. I sleep now in a room and in a bed that once belonged to my father, and the woman that I have loved since I was a boy sleeps beside me at night. For 3 years we were lovers in secret. It was hard for us, and yet somehow all the more delicious. Our trysts were few and uncertain, and I valued them all the more for that. Molly came with her sons to the next harvest fest, and I stole her away from the music and dancing and carried her off to my own bed. I had never thought to have her there, and for many nights after her perfume lingered on my pillows and sweetened my dreams. A visit to her cottage might yield me no more than a swiftly stolen kiss, but each was worth the long ride. I do not think we deceived chivalry for long, and certainly Nettle's comments let me know that I was not fooling her. But we went carefully, for the sake of her little boys, and I have never regretted taking the time to win their regard. No one was more surprised than I when Steady answered the calling. He did not seem to be strongly skilled at first, but we soon uncovered reserves of strength and calm that made him precisely suited to be a king's man. Nettle was proud and protective, and I was grateful, for her young son's residence in Buckkeep Castle gave Molly excuses to visit more often. Steady and Nettle became the core of the new king's coterie, for the bond the brother and sister shared was strong. 12 others answered the calling, 4 with skill enough to become members of Nettle's coterie, and 9 of lesser ability. We turned no one away from that first calling, for as Chade himself pointed out, it sometimes takes time for the skill to manifest itself completely. Thick and I continue to perform the duties of solos. Chade, as always, keeps threads tied to us all and tests the boundaries of the magic, risking himself in ways he would deride as foolhardy if anyone else attempted them.
When Chivalry's second son was born, Molly suddenly declared that it was time Thrift had her own hearth and home. She decided to take Hearth and Just to Withywoods. Nimble made the decision to stay with his older brother, for the holding was too much for one man to work alone, and he had always enjoyed the horses. Molly privately told me that she thought it had more to do with a certain red-headed girl, the daughter of a Wainwright in the closest town. We wed quietly, making our promises before my king in the presence of Molly's children, Catrican, Eliania, Chade, Hap, and Riddle. Chade wept, then hugged me fiercely and told me to be happy. Hap asked Nettle if he might kiss his new sister, and was soundly thumped by a protective Hearth for his impertinence. Thick and little Prince Prosper dozed through most of the ceremony. We travelled to see patients who had not been able to make the journey, and to place a flower on Lacey's grave. We stayed a month, and I thought Hearth and Just would wear patients out with mischief and curiosity, but 2 days before we were scheduled to depart, Patience abruptly announced that she was tired of Tradeford and too old to run it any more, and that she would come to live with us in Withywoods. To my relief, Molly was pleased at the prospect. Hearth and Just seemed to enjoy the pleasures and absurdities of having such a grandmother. Hearth has promised to seek Molly's permission before there is any more tattooing, and Just has developed a deep interest in plants and herbs that challenges even Patience's knowledge. Riddle turned up at Withywoods when we were scarcely settled, saying that Chade had sent him to be my man. I suspect he still spies on me for the old spider, but that is fine. I am willing to yield to Chade whatever he needs to feel he still has control of his world. Much of his power I wrested from him, bit by bit, and passed on to Dutiful as he proved ready for it. If I have never worn the crown of the 6 duchies, I am confident that I have done much to see it passed on intact. Riddle has demonstrated that he knows much more of hiring servants and running an estate than I ever suspected. It is well, for neither Molly nor I ever expected to have to manage such things, and Patience declares she is far too old to bother. He is a solid man. The last time Nettle visited, I took him to task for being overly familiar with her, until Molly called me aside and told me quietly to mind my own business. I am summoned often to Buckkeep, and Dutiful and Eliania have come to visit twice to go hawking, for the birding is excellent in our grain fields. I have never cared for that sport, and spent both visits playing with their son while they rode. Prosper is a hearty, healthy boy. Chade trained arduously, as prescribed in the skill scrolls, and then made one venture through the stones. He chose to go to Aslevjal and explore for himself the Elderling ruins there. He stayed 10 days, and came back with his eyes full of wonder and a sack full of memory cubes. He did not find his way to Prilcop's cave, and if he had, I am sure he would have found it long deserted. I think that when the fool last visited Chade, he was on his way south, back to their schooling place to bring home all they had learned. I doubt he will come back this way again. Ours was a ragged and uneven parting. Each of us had intended to see the other again. Each of us had had final words to say. My days with the fool ended like a half-played game of stones, the outcome poised and uncertain. Possibilities hovering. Sometimes it seemed to me a cruelty that so much was unresolved between us. At other times, a blessing, that a hope at reunion lingered. It is like the anticipation that a clever minstrel evokes when he pauses, letting silence pool before sweeping into the final refrain of his song. Sometimes a gap can be seen like a promise yet to be fulfilled. I miss him often. But in the same way that I miss Night Eyes, I know that such a one will not come again. I count myself fortunate for what I had of them. I do not think I will ever wit bond again, nor know such a deep friendship as I had with the fool. As Burrick once observed to Patience, one horse cannot wear 2 saddles. I have Molly, and she is enough for me, and more. I am content. That was Fool's Fate, Book 3 of the Tawny Man Trilogy, written by Robin Hobb, read by Nicholas Taylor, for HarperCollins Audio.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.